This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Gunmetal Grey, written by Mark Greeny, performed by Jay Snyder. Stay low, go fast, kill first, die last. One shot, one kill, no luck, all skill. Unofficial Navy SEAL slogan. There is only the trying. The rest is not our business. T.S. Eliot. Prologue. The two bodyguards lay unconscious on the floor, arms and legs splayed, an empty bottle of imported whiskey on the table between them. They'd both lost consciousness within seconds of each other, and then they slid out of their chairs and down to the carpet, wholly unaware they'd been drugged, utterly clueless to the fact that the man they were paid to watch over had spiked their booze with a weak supply of nighttime cold medicine. And now the culprit sat on the couch across from them in the darkened hotel room, and he stared at the big men on the floor. His hands trembled as he rubbed his knees. Bile from his stomach churned up and scorched his esophagus. He forced himself to swallow it back down so he could breathe. 26-year-old Fan Xiang made no noise, but his brain screamed.
Go, Fan, get up and run now!
But he could not make himself stand. When the two men on the floor finally woke, it would take them some time to come to their senses and realize their protectee had fled. Fan Xiang knew they would be slow to comprehend the situation, because it was clear to him that Sergeant Leo and Sergeant Chen didn't think that a little shit like him had the balls to make a break for it. The jury was still out on whether they were right or wrong, because 15 minutes after the two men dropped, Fan still sat there paralyzed in the dark. The two Chinese army sergeants were close protection security officers, bodyguards in the parlance of the trade. But the term had a double meaning when applied to these men watching Fan Xiang. True, it was the job of Sergeants Leo and Chen to protect Fan with their lives, throwing their own bodies between any threat and their protectee, if necessary. But it was also their job to bring back Fan Xiang's dead body if he ever tried to run. And now, it was time for him to run. But he just could not fucking get up and go. It was a rare occurrence when Fan Xiang was allowed to leave the military compound in Shanghai where he worked, but he'd been flown over here to Shenzhen along with his minders so he could attend the annual China Information Technology Expo. Fan was a sergeant in the People's Liberation Army, a computer programmer, and one of the most highly placed cyber intrusion specialists in the nation. From time to time, he or others in his unit were sent to see advances in computer tech from international vendors, to ask questions of foreign engineers, and to get a feel for how strong private industry's encryption advances would be 3, 5, 10 years out. So when he needed to travel, Chief Sergeant Class 3 Fan Xiang traded his uniform for civilian clothes and flew on Air China, with Senior Sergeant Chen and Chief Sergeant Class 4 Leo flanking him at all times, themselves in business suits. On the flight over, the security protocol called for the two security officers to take the window and aisle seats while Fan got in the middle, and one of the protectors even followed Fan to the bathroom, standing just outside the door to make certain he had no unauthorized contact. The three men stayed in a suite together at the Sheraton Shenzhen Futian Hotel, a few blocks from the Shenzhen Convention and Exhibition Center, which meant that keeping tabs on Fan was a breeze for Leo and Chen in the off-hours. Each night, when the trade show ended, they all just went back up to the suite and ordered room service. Fan sat on his bed and ate, while his two bodyguards dined on their rollaway beds between Fan and the door, their pistols on or next to their bodies at all times. But during the exhibition itself, it was all work for the bodyguards. The event lasted 3 days, and for 8 to 10 hours each of these days, Fan walked the huge exhibition center floor, posing as an engineer for a Chinese computer firm. Leo and Chen acted as Fan's colleagues, but they said nothing while Fan did all the talking, taking business cards and promotional material and asking techie questions of techie types from all over the world. The two quiet men with him were well trained to keep him safe and to keep him in line, competing roles that could both be best managed only by close physical proximity and constant vigilance. The 3 days on the conference floor passed without incident, But the last evening in Shenzhen was critical because Liu and Chen knew that anyone who attempted to go AWOL while traveling would likely do it either the moment they arrived at their destination or on the last night. The last night was prime time for a man to do a runner, true, but meek little Fan had given them no trouble, nor could either of them envision a scenario that had him acting counter to his orders. He was a tiny, frail, bespectacled, fragile little geek, and when it came down to following commands, he was nothing if not a good soldier. Liu and Chen celebrated the end of the stress of walking the floors of a busy conference full of potential threats for 3 days, having to guard a man in the presence of literally thousands of foreign actors by picking up a bottle of Jack Daniels in a market across the street from the hotel. Neither of them recognized it at the time, but the Jack Daniels was the kid's idea in the first place. He said he needed to get some cold medicine, so the three men entered the market. Fan and Chen walked over to the health aisles, and the younger man picked out what he needed, while Chen looked on, and Liu stood at the front counter. Fan stopped at a liquor display, looked it up and down, and commented on how inexpensive the booze was here as compared to the prices he'd seen on the room service card by his bed. With a shrug, he suggested to Chen that if they wanted to order a drink tonight with their meal, they'd save the Ministry of Defense a lot of yuan by just picking up a bottle here. Liu and Chen were not allowed to drink on the job. Fan knew this, and he also knew they would see this as a perfect opportunity to subvert their orders and enjoy themselves, without anyone in their command being the wiser. A minute later, the men walked out the door of the market with a bottle of whiskey and a bottle of Coke. Their plan had morphed from a quick room service meal and then bed before the early flight the next day back to the lockdown compound in Shanghai to a long evening of drinking and watching television. Now it was 2:30 in the morning, and the bottle of Jack was empty, as was the box of cold medicine. Liu and Chen were incapacitated, true, but Fan was positively frozen himself, worried they'd wake tomorrow and he'd still be right here, staring back at them like a stone statue of a terrified and guilt-ridden little man. Fan took another long look at the two men in the dark. He had nothing against Liu and Chen. They were not nice to him in any respect, but they were government security men. Fan had been around the type since university, and he'd yet to meet one who'd treated a protectee of his low rank with any sort of deference or even kindness. But he knew that they had their job to do, and he had his. And if Fan got away, he knew they'd probably be placed in front of a firing squad for their failure. But Fan rationalized this away. This wasn't his fault. He didn't want to run. He had to run. Finally, he forced himself to stand, to collect his things, and to heave his backpack over his shoulder. With this newfound momentum, he moved as softly as he could across the room and opened the hallway door. He shut it behind him with even more care, then tiptoed away from the hotel room and up the carpeted hall, heading for the stairs. On the way there, he did one last thing. With his heart pounding so hard, he felt certain he could hear it echo off the walls around him. He reached out, put his hand on the fire alarm, and pulled it down. Alarm bells screamed in the still hall, and Fan ran for his life. It was on. There was no turning back. 3 hours before the first light of day, Chief Sergeant Class 3 Fan Xiang of the People's Liberation Army Unit 61398, 2nd Bureau, General Staff Department, 3rd Department, one of the most talented computer hackers on Earth, and one of only a few entrusted with the virtual keys to China's digital kingdom, left through the side entrance of the Sheraton in the middle of a large group of guests that overwhelmed hotel security, a fast-moving mass of humanity reacting to the fire alarm. When Fan was clear of the crowd on the street, he turned to the south and then headed off through the city, in the general direction of mainland China's border with Hong Kong. Chapter 1 Hong Kong, Special Administrative Region of the People's Republic of China, 10 days later. The sleek executive jet descended out of the gray clouds, just 3 miles west of runway 07 left. As it lowered its landing gear, a set of binoculars focused on the plane, watching it streak over the water on its final approach.
I've always wanted to kill a CIA officer with my own hands. I've dreamed of the day, wrapping my fingers around his throat, squeezing the life from him, watching his eyes bug out and then go blank.
The comment was in Mandarin, and it came not from the man with the binoculars, but from his partner on his left. Both stood on the roof of an airport outbuilding, doing their best to ignore the stifling morning heat. The man with the binoculars also did his best to ignore his colleague, and kept his focus on the approaching aircraft. He replied in Mandarin as well.
Dassault Falcon might be a Model 7X. This should be our target. Can you read the tail number? Negative, still too far. Killing a CIA man won't be anything like that guy I strangled Monday. I predict a CIA man will have real muscles in his neck. He'll be a real fighter.
With a muted sigh, the man with the binoculars said,
Why are you talking like this, Tao? Because if someone gets off that plane, I predict control will order us to terminate them. What do you think? I think you're almost as crazy as control.
The man behind the Pentax binos kept his gaze fixed on the airplane as it touched down, then slowed on the runway. He checked the tail number now that it was close enough to make out through the 10 power lenses.
It's a match. Good.
Both men were relieved to see that the intelligence reports about the arrival of the plane had been accurate. The aircraft from America was right on time, and this meant the duo wouldn't have to stand around up here on the hot roof all damn day. While the man with the optics watched carefully, the aircraft taxied to the customs ramp, then over to the tarmac in front of Hong Kong Business Aviation Center, a fixed base operator popular with high-end corporate jets visiting the city. Both Chinese nationals lowered their bodies to low squats to decrease any faint chance they could be detected from a cabin window. They didn't expect to be spotted, because they did this sort of thing all the time and were confident in their skills. But the target today was likely to be someone adept in surveillance detection and counter-surveillance measures, so they took no chances. As intelligence officers with China's Ministry of State Security, Wan Ping Li and Tao Man Ko were, by law anyway, precluded from working here without notifying the authorities in the Special Administrative Region of Hong Kong of the People's Republic of China. The mainland had its rules, and HK, officially speaking, followed a different set of rules when it came to security matters. But these men were spies, and spies rarely followed the rules, and these two even less so, because they weren't just any spies. Their real mission in Hong Kong, the reason Tao and Wong and 2 dozen other men like them were here in the first place, meant they wouldn't be checking in with the local authorities. They were ghosts. Smoke. They were assassins. Wong didn't like this morning's pedestrian work, but he understood the situation. Airplanes operated by known CIA front companies landed at Hong Kong International Airport from time to time, but never this particular jet, so these two intelligence officers had been sent to check it out. It was a distraction, but orders were orders, and they'd been ordered here. That these were the only men close enough to respond to the request by the Ministry of State Security was unfortunate for them. Their real job here was for the Ministry of Defense. It was high-end wet work, and if it turned out getting an ID of the passengers of the Falcon took more than a couple of hours, their MOD control officer would hear they were off his job, and he'd ride them hard about it. Their orders from Beijing be damned. Because, in the viewpoint of these two men, MOD control was fucking nuts and getting crazier by the day. Wong and Tao both had their long-range cameras out when the aircraft's main hatch opened, and a black Mercedes S-Class pulled up in front of it. A rear door opened on the far side of the car, and both intelligence operatives focused their lenses there, assuming the Mercedes would disgorge a passenger. But the opposite happened. A man carrying his own luggage stepped down the jet stairs quickly and disappeared into the front passenger seat behind the smoked glass of the Mercedes.
Shit! Did you get him? Wong asked quietly. I'm not a photographer. If I had a sniper rifle, he'd be dead now. Not what I asked. I was focused on the back door of the Mercedes. I thought someone would come out. You? I'll check.
Wong looked back at the digital images on his camera.
I don't have a clear image of the face. He's shielding the sun with his hand. Dark hair, beard, gray suit, sunglasses. He's Western for certain. Gold wedding band on his left hand, raw aboard luggage and a backpack. Whoever he is, he'll be dead by sundown.
Wong stowed his camera in his backpack.
Would you stop with that already? Let's get to the car. Their limo service is geo-tracked. We can see the movements of each car in their fleet from my laptop. Wherever the Mercedes takes him, we'll know. And if this man should get out along the route?
The two walked quickly along the roof towards the stairs, their suits sticking to them with perspiration. Tao asked,
Why would he do that?
Wong replied,
Because he is CIA and trained in counter-surveillance.
Tao felt some shame in not thinking the situation through. He made up for his humiliation by being the first to arrive at the stairs and the first to make it down to the black Toyota Orion, an Australian-made vehicle that blended in well with the traffic here in the city of nearly 8 million. With Tao behind the wheel, they fell in behind the black Mercedes as it left the front gate of the Hong Kong Business Aviation Center and entered the busy morning traffic of Chur La Jock Road. While he drove, Tao said,
Colonel Dai is going to find out we're off tailing some guy who has nothing to do with our assignment for MOD, and he's going to order us to terminate him, or else Dai will take it out on us, give us the crap jobs, and reprimand. The Americans have a saying.
He switched to English because both men spoke it well.
Shit runs downhill.
Wong sniffed.
That's not a saying, that's physics.
And then he continued.
If anything, Colonel Dai will get us to rough him up, interrogate him, scare him out of town. This won't go lethal.
With that, Tao took his eyes off the road in front of him and looked to his passenger.
Disagree. Dai had us kill the man at the border, and he had Su and Lin kill the two triads in Shek Kong. Fan Xiang's bodyguards were executed the day after he ran in Shenzhen, and Dai gave that order as well. The colonel is in a killing mood on this job, you must admit. I say Dai will have us terminate this CIA boy and dump his body in the harbor and then lie to Beijing about it.
Tao sniffed.
Dai is mad. Stark raving,
Wong agreed.
But a dead CIA officer in Hong Kong will just make his operation more complicated, not less.
Tao was unyielding in his opinion.
Complicated for us, not for him. Colonel Dai doesn't give a damn. Beijing has given Dai free rein, so that man in that Mercedes will be dead by midnight. There are no fucking rules for Dai in Hong Kong these days.
After a dry little chuckle in the back of his throat, he added,
The streets of this city will be running rivers of blood before this one's over.
Chapter 2 Cortland Gentry sat in the front passenger seat of the Mercedes, much to the confusion of his driver. Normally, passengers sat in the back, and their luggage rode in the trunk. But Cort had hurried off the aircraft and into the front of the car to disrupt any potential surveillance at the FBO. And since the driver didn't know anything about tradecraft, he thought this American to be some kind of a weirdo. Cort hadn't seen the two men on the roof, but he saw them now, or at least he saw the black Orion, varying between 6 and 10 car lengths behind his Mercedes, always there, despite the turnoffs, red lights, and off and on gridlocked traffic of a Hong Kong workday. Cort had picked up a tail, and he hadn't even been on the ground here in HK for 10 fucking minutes. Terrific. He considered bailing out of the Mercedes somewhere en route to his destination to lose the surveillance detail, but he figured this driver was probably an informant for Chinese intelligence, and the man would just pass on the fact that his passenger had, with no warning, dived from his hired car and dashed up some alley. Nope, that wouldn't do. Cort's cover for status had to be maintained, which meant Cort would just pretend like he didn't see the black car lurking behind him. He'd been here to HK before, but only once. To the extent he had a regular beat, East Asia certainly wasn't it. So he did his best to push the tail car out of his mind and instead spent his time doing all he could to observe the fabric of life on the streets around him. He noted what the police cars looked like, where the street signs were located, the flow of traffic, and the manner of dress of the commuters. He made a mental note of the cardinal positions of several major buildings in view. He'd spent hours of his flight over from the States prepping for his op here, but he'd not had time to digest more than a thumbnail sketch of this area of operations and, as he had learned countless times in the past, not only was the map not the territory, but most preconceived notions about a place were dead wrong. You really had to experience a location to know it at an operational level. Court had a lot of work to do to get up to speed, but his assignment here was as time-sensitive as they came, so he'd have to work out the atmospherics of this AO while on the job. His car drove onto the Tsingyi Bridge, and he glanced back in the passenger side mirror to confirm that the black Orion continued to follow. It was in a reasonable position for a tail car. Court gave these boys credit for knowing their stuff, but he had been either the tailor or the tailee thousands of times in his life, so sniffing out a car on his six was nothing to him. Both vehicles left the bridge, continued south along the water, and finally entered the Hong Kong district of Tsim Sha Tsui, on the southern tip of Kowloon. The black sedan was still back there, which meant to Court this tail on him was a simple affair. There were no teams of vehicles in radio contact leapfrogging all around, which was what he would have expected if mainland China's Ministry of State Security was working here and had ordered up a large surveillance package on him. Either the guys in the tail car were working for some group not tied to the Chinese intelligence services, or else Chinese intel found him more of a curiosity than a real concern. So they just sent a couple of men to see where he was heading and what he was up to. Looking away from the mirror, he got his first glimpse of his hotel. The five-star peninsula Hong Kong sat on the southern tip of Kowloon, just across the street from the harbor ferry terminal. He was anxious to get into his room, not so he could rest after the two-leg 19-hour flight from the United States, rather so he could whip out his encrypted phone and call his handler. He would let her know about the surveillance, and he would let her have it, because this bullshit wasn't his damn fault, and it could ruin this mission before it began. No, Court told himself, this wouldn't hurt the op, it couldn't, because his assignment here was possibly the most important of his life. The potential for gain was exponentially larger than any intelligence haul he'd ever heard of, short of wartime. And lives were on the line, including the life of a man who had saved Court Gentry years ago. Court told himself he would not fail. Regardless of the hurdles ahead, he would see this through somehow, even if he had these Chinese motherfuckers breathing down his neck for the duration of his assignment. The Mercedes drove around the fountain in front of the peninsula and stopped under the awning. A bellman opened the back door, but Court climbed out of the front seat with barely a nod to his driver. He handled his own luggage and passed the attentive bellman with a curt nod, like he was a businessman who did this every day of his life. A stunning fleet of green Rolls-Royce Phantoms, 8 in total, were lined up near the entrance to the hotel, and Court pretended to give a damn about them, just as a foreign businessman might. He knew the cars were here to take the well-heeled guests to and fro around Hong Kong, and he wouldn't mind going for a ride in the back of a luxurious classic car, but this wasn't going to be that type of assignment. No. He figured he'd likely spend his time skulking alone in shady alleys and cracking heads in opium dens and strip clubs. Despite the nice hotel and his nice suit, he fully expected to find himself serving as a low-grade ground pounder on this gig, not a high-flying cocktail circuit spook. After slowing a moment to fulfill his cover by looking over the Rolls-Royce fleet approvingly, he returned to his brisk pace and entered the lobby. 5 minutes later, he was checked into his 25th floor room. It wasn't a suite, but it was roomy and ornate. It came with a dramatic floor-to-ceiling view of Victoria Harbor. Beyond the congested waterway, the massive skyscrapers of Hong Kong Island shot skyward. Past the stunning urban landscape, lush hills dwarfed the buildings, and Victoria Peak, the highest point in HK, was completely hidden by the low cloud ceiling. Court took in the view just for a moment before dropping his rollerboard and his backpack on the bed, fishing in his luggage for his mobile phone and its battery, and reassembling the device. He turned on his room's impressive stereo system, made sure the surround sound speakers were each playing with the all-channel stereo mode to remove the chance that a hidden surveillance mic happened to be positioned near a speaker that was only blaring music intermittently, and then he chose a station playing some annoying techno that was sure to madden anyone who might be eavesdropping. Court then entered the spacious bathroom and turned on the spigot in the tub. The sounds of water moving through pipes in the walls would play havoc on a microphone positioned nearby. More than once in his own career, he'd had to yank headphones from his ears and throw them across the room to save himself from the roar of a filling tub or the thunder of a flushing toilet. Court's mobile was encrypted with non-proprietary, off-the-shelf software that had been tweaked to improve the performance of the encryption, but not augmented with any gadgetry that would give away the fact that Court got it from the Science and Technology Division of the CIA. It would withstand examination by experts at even top-tier intelligence organizations. If they ever got their hands on it, he'd seem like a paranoid businessman, an anti-surveillance technology geek, but he would not look like a government spy. Gentry's primary cover was as an American businessman, but his secondary cover was that of a freelance assassin, a hitman without portfolio, and he wasn't about to give that away by using gear with the agency's fingerprints on it. It took a moment for his phone to establish a connection, but when it went through, the call was answered on the first ring.
Brewer.
Court checked his watch and saw that it was 10 p.m. in Langley, Virginia, and he wondered if Suzanne Brewer was still in her office. He said,
Violator.
Identity challenge, Roadster.
He heard a hint of relief in her voice. Court knew she'd been anticipating his call.
My response is Renaissance.
Challenge response confirmed. I assume your operation is proceeding nominally.
Not even close. There's a problem.
A problem? By the clock on my desk, you should just now be arriving at your hotel. Is your bed too lumpy?
I've got a tail.
Oh. A pause. Are you?
Court interrupted.
Yes, I'm sure.
How the hell did you manage to pick up a tail?
My plane landed and there was a surveillance team waiting for me in a car as I left the airport.
Another pause.
That's problematic.
Problematic? At Langley, yeah, I guess that's how it looks. Here, from my angle, it looks like an utter clusterfuck. How am I supposed to do this job with eyes on me?
Brewer remained detached and professional.
I understand your concern, Violator. I'll begin a review immediately. Look into the aircraft. See if there's a chance.
Who knows about this operation?
Brewer answered without hesitation.
You, me, and Hanley. Full stop.
Matthew Hanley was the CIA's new director of the National Clandestine Service. Court had a long history with Hanley, whereas his relationship with Suzanne Brewer was less than 24 hours old. But she was his handler, his single contact, his one lifeline with the agency on this operation. He had to work with her, and to some extent, he had to trust her. But Court wasn't a trusting guy.
You're sure about that?
Absolutely certain. Look, this isn't about you. Can't be. Whoever it is that's following you doesn't know who you are. They must just somehow know the plane belongs to us, so whoever climbed off the plane is now their target.
I hope you're right,
Brewer said.
I'm always right. We just met, so you can't know that yet, but you will learn soon enough.
You sure as hell weren't right about the jet.
That wasn't my jet. That was the transport Hanley arranged. I'm as new to this op as you are.
She thought a moment.
If the Chinese know it's an agency asset, then we won't use it again. When the job is done, I'll fly you out of there on a clean aircraft. I promise you that.
Court gazed out the window and down at the harbor, 25 floors down. Dozens of different watercraft of all sizes and types were in sight.
Maybe I'd be safer on one of these old junks bobbing in the harbor.
That's your call, but until you complete your op, no slow boats for you. The clock is ticking. You know what's at stake here.
Court breathed into the phone for a moment.
The men tailing me, do they pose a physical danger?
How can I answer that? I don't even know who they are.
I only spotted one vehicle, but the surveillance was competently conducted. I'm guessing they are MSS. My question is, have any Chinese intel operatives killed any agency operatives in the past, I don't know, 10 years?
Brewer was unequivocal in her response.
Negative. It's been more than 20 years, actually. And you're in Hong Kong, not Beijing. Hong Kong has autonomy, in theory, anyway. If MSS is roving around there in force, it would only happen after the Chinese broke a lot of rules.
But it could happen.
Brewer walked back her last comment.
Sure, we know MSS is there in Hong Kong, obviously. Your entire operation is based on the presumption that the Chinese are conducting intel ops in HK. I'm only saying it isn't the same as it would be if you were on the mainland, in Beijing or Shanghai.
Also, there are transnational criminal groups in HK, the triads, a few of whom China holds some sway over.
So you're saying the MSS might send some local gang to target me?
She thought this over before answering.
I guess it's possible if they felt they had to, but you won't give them a reason now, will you?
Court lay back on the bed, staring at the ceiling.
For some reason, I tend to find my way to people's wrong side.
Then I guess you'll have to be on your best behavior.
Court blew out a sigh.
Look, I'm going below radar.
What does that mean?
It means I need to lose these guys to shake any possible compromise. I won't be checking in for a while.
Brewer took her time responding. Then she said,
Well, you are certainly experienced in working alone.
And I'm sure you are experienced in conducting reviews of company failures.
It was a shitty thing to say. Court knew he didn't need to get off on a bad foot with Suzanne Brewer, but he'd been on his own for 5 years and was unaccustomed to this bullshit. He was back with the agency for the first time in a half decade, in a thin quasi-relationship anyway, and he wasn't a team player who knew how to pick and choose his battles. Brewer could have gotten her hackles up, Court realized, but instead she remained professional and even contrite.
Remember, you aren't there on a direct action mission. You make contact with your target, garner as much intel as you can about the situation, then report in and get out of there. This isn't you against the bad guys, she added. Sorry about the glitch here at the beginning.
Court Gentry softened.
It's not your fault. I'll check in down the road.
He hung up, then listened to the techno music for a minute more. Soon, he climbed off the bed, crossed the room, and turned that shit off. 25 floors below, Wong Ping Li and Tao Man Ko sat in a conference room in the administrative suite of the Peninsula Hotel, watching silently while the day manager stood and left the room. The man had been angry about informing on one of his guests, and he'd made a show about demanding Wong and Tao's credentials, but it was only a show. And while both operatives knew they could have filed a report on the manager's recalcitrance, they weren't here in HK to gauge the party loyalty of hoteliers. And anyway, after a little huffing and puffing, the manager was playing ball. He'd already told them that the guest who'd arrived in the Mercedes was traveling under the name Roger Hartley, and he was, ostensibly, a businessman from Ohio in the United States. The intelligence officers didn't have the man's passport to look at. Hotels here in Hong Kong, unlike in China proper, were under no obligation to take their guests' passports, and the five-star properties like the Peninsula distanced themselves from China by not doing so. But even though on the surface the Peninsula acted high-minded about guests' rights, in truth, Roger Hartley's room was already bugged with listening devices. Most four- and five-star hotels in HK maintained rooms wired by MSS as a matter of course, though the bugs weren't turned on unless there was a specific need. Tao would make a call to initiate 24-hour monitoring of Hartley's room now that he had the room number, and he'd follow up hourly with the listeners for updates. The manager returned with a pair of key cards and handed them over without a word. This would give Tao and Wong access to the room directly across the hall from Hartley. As it happened, it had been vacant. But if a guest had been staying there, the annoyed hotel manager would have moved them out under some emergency repair ruse. Through a pinhole camera Wong and Tao would attach to their door's peephole, they would have a perfect view of Hartley's door. And through the motion detector setting on the device, they'd be sure they wouldn't miss him leaving his room. The manager had also handed over extra copies of cards that would get them into Hartley's room itself, in case they wanted to make entry when the man was out. After passing over the key cards, the manager walked the two intelligence operatives out of the conference room and back into the lobby. He bid them an insincere good day, then turned and went back inside. Tao looked to Wong.
He was disrespectful.
No time to make trouble for him. He gets a pass for now. Let's go to the room.
Tao nodded, then said,
Should we call in more eyes to assist?
Who? Everyone else here is working for Ministry of Defense. When Colonel Dai finds out we have been pulled off his operation, he'll be angry enough. If we start removing others to help us, he'll lose his mind.
The two men headed for the elevators. As soon as the doors closed, the mobile phone rang in Tao's jacket. He looked at the incoming number, then immediately handed the phone over to Wong.
Is him?
Wong took the phone from Tao and answered with a report, not even waiting to be asked where the hell they were.
Wei ni hao, Xiang Qiao.
Yes, hello, Colonel.
We were ordered by our Beijing control to divert from your operation here and proceed to the airport. An American CIA Dassault Falcon 7X, tail number.
Wong stopped talking abruptly and just listened. Tao could tell he'd been interrupted. The elevator stopped and the two men headed up the hall. Wong spoke again, more softly now.
Yes, sir. Our orders were made clear to us. We then followed our subject to the peninsula, and we have taken our room across from...
He stopped speaking again. Tao could hear the voice of the man through the phone at Wong's ear. The two men were already in their room with the door shut when Wong spoke again.
I understand, sir. But this came from our department, not yours. Apologies, but despite our seconding to you, our chain of command retains authority to...
For a third time, Wong was interrupted. Tao looked on while Wong listened, nodded compliantly, and ended the call. He looked uncomfortable but made no remarks to his junior colleague.
What did he say?
Tao finally asked.
What do you think? He's mad we left his op to follow the MSS directive, as if we had a choice.
Tao was the junior man, but he chanced to comment.
Colonel Dai has his own ass on the line on this operation for some reason. The next call we get from him will be the one ordering us to terminate the subject.
Wong took off his suit coat, still a little damp from his time on the hot roof at the airport.
He's after a promotion, or maybe, as you suggest, there is some other reason for his personal involvement. If Dai fails here, it will be men like us who will suffer.
Tao held up a finger.
No, not men like us. It will be us, exactly. That's why we should terminate the CIA man, and...
Wong waved a hand in the air.
I've been doing this longer than you, Tao. Get it out of your head. We are here on a surveillance job for MSS,
and then we will go back to being two more good little soldiers for Ministry of Defense.
Nobody is killing anybody until we find Fang Xiang, or until someone gets in our way.
Tao said,
Roger Hartley is in Dai's way already, and Colonel Dai doesn't mess around.
Chapter 3 Cort had spent almost all of the past 19 hours in the air, and he'd worked through nearly all of the flight. He'd known nothing about his assignment when he boarded the Falcon, not even if he would accept it. But before the plane took to the sky, he'd read his eyes-only orders, and he was fully on board with the mission. And by the time the plane had reached its cruising altitude, Cort had sketched out a mental to-do list for the long flight ahead of him. The flight attendant, herself a CIA employee, had brought him dinner and offered him drinks, but he ate lightly and drank nothing but water and coffee, knowing he needed a plan of action to hit the ground running in HK, more than he needed a buzz, a heavy stomach, and some shut-eye. Now he knew that both jet lag and hunger would kick in before long, but he had more work to do. He opened his carry-on and his backpack and dumped everything out onto the bed. He went through each item slowly and carefully, because he'd not packed these bags himself, and none of these belongings were his. He'd already been through this gear on the plane, but he wanted to go over it again. In addition to clothing and toiletries, it had all manner of mission-specific items, from encrypted mobiles to infrared scopes masked as binoculars. He'd taken only a small portion of the equipment left for him on the Falcon, and now he decided to pare this down even more. Most anything could have a GPS tracker in it these days, and he didn't want the CIA knowing his exact whereabouts, just in case someone in the CIA had passed on the tip about the plane's identity and arrival here in the first place. Now he sat on his bed and searched everything that came off the plane with him. He found nothing that raised an eyebrow, so he thought it likely that Brewer was right. The aircraft itself had been compromised. He knew what he had to do to get back on track. Tonight, he would lose his tail, and tomorrow, when no one knew he was the guy who got off that CIA aircraft, he would intentionally pick his tail back up again, because those were his orders from Langley. This was going to be a weird op. Of this, he was certain. He'd come to meet a man who had been detained by the Chinese, and since he didn't know where this man was, the only way to find him was to make the Chinese aware of who he was and who he was looking for. But they could not know he was here on a mission for the CIA, or this whole operation would fall to pieces. He grabbed a pillow from the bed, stepped into the closet, lay down on the carpet, and fell asleep while the hot Hong Kong day raged on outside. Several hours later, Court sat at the bar at the Felix, an ultra-chic Philippe Starck-designed restaurant on the top floor of the hotel. The view over the harbor was breathtaking. The lights of Hong Kong Island to the south looked like the Manhattan skyline as seen by a helicopter from just a few hundred yards away. In fact, in many ways, it was more dramatic. HK was the world's tallest urban agglomeration, with one building reaching 118 stories and 312 buildings here standing at least 150 yards high, many more than in New York City. While Court ate a steak and drank a beer at the bar with his back to the windows, 44 buildings on both sides of Victoria Harbor flashed colors synchronized to music in the nightly symphony of light show. Well-dressed men and women stood at the windows of the Felix and marveled at the spectacle, even though it happened every evening. Court didn't turn and look at the lights, and neither did one other man in the room. Tao Man Ko sat at a table near the window high above the harbor and sipped a glass of wine. Through the reflection in the glass next to him, he could see the back of the American, and he kept his eyes out for anyone who might try to communicate with him in a clandestine fashion. So far, he'd not seen a thing that gave him any impression that Roger Hartley was anything other than a businessman here having a meal. But he continued his covert surveillance, careful not to give himself away. While Tao watched the target, his partner, Wang Ping Li, stood in the middle of the hotel room of the man he knew as Roger Hartley, checking the area carefully one more time. He'd done this an hour earlier upon his arrival in the room, scanning for anything out of the ordinary, thinking that if Hartley was CIA, he might have prepped his room with hidden cameras or listening devices of his own, or he might have placed objects in specific ways so that he'd know immediately if anything had been tampered with. It was Tradecraft 101, and while Wang worked these days as a direct action operative for the Ministry of State Security, he'd been trained as a simple spook, and he knew how to scan a room for telltales. Wang had spent an additional half hour going through the man's luggage, taking apart his laptop, and looking through the top dozen places someone might hide items in a hotel room. He took the drawer out of the desk, unscrewed heating ducts, searched below trash can liners, behind wall art, under the mattress, even in the toilet tank. He didn't find a single item of interest. The phone buzzed in Wang's pocket, and he checked it quickly. It was Tao. Wang answered in a whisper.
He's moving? Negative. No movement. He ate dinner, and he is just sitting and drinking a... I don't give a shit what he's drinking. You ought to inform me when he leaves.
Tao asked.
Anything in his room? Nothing. Unless he has something on him right now, he is clean. We might find ourselves following this son of a bitch for days, waiting for him to meet someone. Doubt it.
Before Wang could respond, his phone told him another call was coming.
Shit. It's Dai now. Let me know what he...
Wang hung up and rejected the new call. He wasn't going to talk to Dai from his target's room. Instead, he left and went across the 25th floor hallway to his own room, where he immediately hit redial. Dai answered after several rings.
Still on your little errand for Beijing?
Yes, sir.
What do you have to report?
Our target is sitting in the Felix Bar at the top of the peninsula.
What is he doing? He had dinner, and now he's drinking. Just sitting there. We think he may be waiting to meet someone, but perhaps he's just jet-lagged and lingering over dinner. I have searched his room, but I found nothing to indicate why he is here.
I didn't bring you and Tao to Hong Kong to sit in a bar all night. Your real target here could be slipping out of the city at this very moment.
I understand, sir. But I saw no way to avoid my orders from the Ministry of State Security, which supersedes your command at the Ministry of Defense. I report first to...
Wang, let me ask you. When I snap your neck the next time I see you, will that supersede your orders from State Security?
Wang just gazed at the floor of his hotel room. Finally, he said,
What do you want me to do, sir?
Has MSS ordered you to move on the target?
No, just investigate and report contacts.
How long is the target registered at the hotel?
Wang hesitated, knowing his answer was going to send Colonel Dai into orbit.
8 days, sir.
As Wang fully expected, Dai screamed at him.
You aren't staying in a fucking hotel for 8 days.
Sir, if you would like to speak with MSS, I am sure they can send in another team from Beijing, and...
They already have more assets here in Hong Kong than they are comfortable with. They won't send anyone else.
Wang had no answer to this, so he just sat there, his phone to his ear.
You will confront the target, immediately.
I'm sorry, sir. I don't understand.
I am ordering you to end this wasted journey and take him. I'm not telling you to terminate the subject. You have drugs to obtain information, do you not?
You issued them to each of us the day we arrived.
Use them. Find out who he is, what he wants. Those drugs will render his memory foggy, so he won't have any idea you questioned him. Then, throw him in this bathtub, turn the shower on, and break his leg with the heel of your shoe. When he wakes, he'll be too fucked up to know what happened, and too injured to continue his mission here.
Wang spoke the truth now, but his heart wasn't in it. He knew he would lose.
Colonel, you have no authority to order me to circumvent my orders from my divisional director.
My op here is a national priority mission. I will pull rank on you and change your orders. Call your masters at MSS in exactly 15 minutes, and you will see that your mandate and rules of engagement have been updated. But after that, return to Beijing. Don't come back to me. I'll have no use for you or your partner after you challenge my authority. I have 34 other men here who would not dare this insubordination that you seem so comfortable with.
Wang knew this was bullshit. Dai was just being petulant. But Wang also knew Dai had the capacity to make his life hell if he disobeyed him. Wang said,
No need to contact Beijing, sir. We will comply immediately.
Wang didn't need enemies at MOD, especially not someone who could make or break everyone in his family. And on top of this, Wang wouldn't mind roughing up the CIA officer. He'd never done that before.
Very well,
Dai said.
I will do as you say and report back to you with what we found out.
Dai snapped back.
No, you can tell MSS all about your American. I don't care about him. I only care about my target here in HK. I want you back on my job first thing in the morning.
Shi de xing shang.
Yes, sir. Wang hung up and called Tao. Tao answered with,
Target has asked for the check. Our plans have changed.
Wang explained Dai's orders. When Wang finished, Tao asked,
Rules of engagement? We force compliance. We meet resistance with escalating resistance.
Up to?
A pause.
Up to everything.
Told you.
You told me this would be an assassination. It's not that. We take him as he returns to his room, overpower him, tie him up, drug him, get the intel, and bust him up. Dai wants us back with him in the morning. I hope this guy is a fighter.
Tao chuckled.
I'll get my check and head down.
Court didn't really want the third beer. He'd barely sipped it, spending most of his time fiddling with his wedding band and pretending to surf the internet on his phone. He only wore the band for the op, He wasn't married, but the agency had put it in his backpack on the plane, and he'd recognized it for what it was. So he slipped it on, along with a set of designer eyeglasses that did nothing for his vision, but used a special refracted glass to break up the outline of his face to hamper facial recognition software. Court took his time lounging here at the bar, for the simple reason that he wanted the lookout seated behind him to report to whoever was in his room right now that the coast was clear. He'd ID'd the watcher minutes after sitting down, pegged him as likely to be one of the men who'd followed him from the airport, because this still felt like a small op. If he was right about that, then there would be just a few other men involved, and they would be conducting a site exploration in Court's room 3 floors below right now. If this was indeed the case, Court wanted to give them plenty of time to do their work. It wasn't that Court was afraid to confront a couple of guys in his room. The fact was, he didn't need the aggravation. He wanted to give the Chinese the time they needed to go through his belongings so he could convince them he was no one worth following, or at least that they didn't need to call in any backup. He decided to simply check out of his hotel tomorrow morning and lose his tail then, but for now, he just wanted to look as sedentary, non-threatening, and downright boring as possible to the men watching him. Finally, he paid his bill, then went to the bathroom here at the Felix to take a leak, giving the men downstairs even more time to clear out of his room. He stood at a space-age-looking urinal in front of floor-to-ceiling windows that looked out and down 28 floors, which Court found bizarre and a little silly, but it was a decent distraction for a man taking his time while taking a piss, and as far as bathrooms went, this one was indeed memorable. He headed for the elevator. The watcher was gone from his seat by the windows, which Court hoped meant his surveillance team had pulled the plug for the night. Court fiddled with his keycard outside his door for a moment, then slid it into the lock, all the while hoping like hell the sweep had been completed and the man performing it had done a decent job hiding evidence of his search. If it was obvious his belongings had been disturbed, he'd need to report it to hotel management, just to continue along with his ruse that he was like any other Western businessman here. It would be in keeping with his cover that he'd freak out if someone went through his stuff while he was at dinner, so if the goons who searched his room couldn't be bothered to refold his clothes and zip his luggage back up, then Court would have to make a scene. As Court entered his room, his shoulders sank. Down the little entry hall, past the bathroom ahead on his left, he could just see the front edge of his king-sized bed. His laptop was lying open there. Cords, chargers, and socks were strewn about, hanging down to the floor. Shit. His room had been tossed. He'd have to call the front desk and throw a fit, to pretend he thought housekeeping and rummage through his belongings. As he moved forward into the room, he knew the bathroom on his left was a blind spot, and there was a chance a member of the site exploration team was still in there, either working or hiding. The chance was small considering the lookout in the bar had been given 10 minutes to warn anyone in his room, but if these guys sucked so bad at their job they didn't even try to clean up after themselves, it was also possible their comms were down. But even though he thought it possible he might be about to disturb someone in the act, he knew he had to remain in cover. He couldn't just fly into the room and waylay anyone standing there. That wasn't the normal behavior of a businessman who had just downed a steak dinner at a swanky bar. If it turned out there was someone in there squeezing out Court's toothpaste into a rubber glove, Court would just feign shock and confusion, then adopt a posture of nervous anger. He passed the bathroom and looked in matter-of-factly, and suddenly, his already thumping heart began to pound harder. An Asian man in a black tracksuit and dark wraparound sunglasses sat on the toilet seat, and he held a pistol with a suppressor on the end, leveled at Court's chest. This Court had not expected. He slowly raised his hands. Now he heard the keycard placed in the door behind him, and then a second man entered. Court looked back over his shoulder to confirm that it was the man in the suit and tie from the bar. He wore dark sunglasses now as well. So, still just the two guys, he said to himself. It seemed to him MSS could scare up 15 operatives if they wanted something bad to happen to a CIA officer in HK. Perhaps whatever was going on here was off book. Or MSS just didn't think they needed much muscle to do whatever it was they were about to do. Court thought about Suzanne Brewer's assurances that MSS didn't get physical with CIA. Either these dudes weren't MSS, they didn't think he was CIA, or the rules had changed. There was an equation he'd have to solve to sort all this out, but that was a problem for down the road. The man in the bathroom stood up slowly. He appeared calm, professional, and his English was accented, but more than adequate.
"Sit on chair by window."
He motioned with the pistol for Court to enter the bedroom, and Court complied. Across the ransacked space, a swivel chair pulled out from the desk sat positioned with its back just inches away from the 25th floor window, looking out over Victoria Harbor. On the desk to the right of the chair, a set of high-end steel handcuffs lay on a towel. Court said,
"If it's money, I have a little cash. My credit cards are in my..."
He felt the tip of the suppressor of the pistol jabbed against the back of his head. The man in the tracksuit spoke from behind.
"You sit in chair."
Court sighed now.
"Okay, pal, I sit in chair."
Court crossed the room and sat down. The man in the business suit spun him around to face the window. Court couldn't help but look straight down, 20 stories, to the roof of an adjacent 7-story building below. Beyond that was a busy road, the headlights and taillights snaking in either direction in red and white. Court felt hands on his wrists, and then his arms were yanked behind him and the steel cuffs were clicked tightly in place. His pockets were rummaged through. His wallet, his phone, and his hotel room key were tossed on the bed, and then he was swung back around to face the two men. The men spoke to each other in Mandarin for a moment. Neither seemed particularly worked up about what they were doing. Then the guy in the tracksuit disappeared into the bathroom. While he was out of view, Court looked to the other man.
"Do you speak English? Will you tell me what is going on?"
The man in the business suit made no reply. Instead, he just went to the bed, laid his pistol down on it, and unzipped a black satchel. From it, he pulled out two small blue items. In seconds, he opened one up, and Court recognized it for what it was. A surgical mask.
Uh-oh.
Chapter 4. Tracksuit returned from the bathroom with his suppressed pistol stuck inside his waistband. In his hands, he held what appeared to be a Mont Blanc fountain pen. Business suit placed a second surgical mask over Tracksuit's face, then pulled out his phone. Court noted the man's pistol was still on the bed, which told him these guys were more than confident in their capabilities. Tracksuit waved the pen in the air.
"Do you know what this is?"
Court lied. He was pretty sure he knew, but his cover identity would not have a clue.
"It's a pen."
"No. It is designed to look like pen, but in fact, it's blowgun that uses compressed air to fire powerful powder that will alter your mind."
"Heroin? What are you going to do with?"
"No, not heroin. Scopolamine hydrobromide. A truth drug. I blow this in your face, and you will tell us what we want to know within minutes. Of course, you will be zombie for hours, but that is just side effect."
Court pushed a crack into his voice, the tenor of a man on the verge of panic.
Jesus! I'll tell you now! No reason to use that shit! I'm just a businessman from Cleveland here in town to... What are you doing?"
Business suit stepped forward, raised his phone, and took a picture of Court's face, then stepped back to the far side of the bed, near the pistol lying there. Court watched while the man thumbed keys on his phone. He assumed the man was about to email or text the photo to someone. While business suit did this calmly, Tracksuit unscrewed the front of the pen. Like his partner, he was as relaxed as he could be. This was just another day at work for the two of them. Court realized quickly he wasn't going to be able to talk his way out of this, to satisfy these two that they had the wrong man, or that the CIA plane he'd arrived in was something other than a CIA plane. And Court also knew there was absolutely no way to keep them from sending that picture to Chinese intelligence officials, something that would irrevocably ruin his mission here in Hong Kong. Actually, there was a way. One way to save the mission. One way to stop this op from falling apart before it even began. These two men had to die. Behind the chair, Court's left hand reached over to his right hand, and he slipped the gold wedding band off.